gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Good morning. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. StephanieMiller.com. All that business out of the way. I hope you guys had a wonderful Christmas weekend, if that's how you roll. And if not, you spent a good 4 days either with family and enjoying the nature of the holiday, or away from them and enjoying it even more. I don't know if that's how you roll personally. But for me, I took the day and I had friends over. We had presents in the morning, and then we went and saw Avatar, which was, I think that it was the lefty thing to do, really, was spend Christmas Day seeing Avatar. And then afterwards, went to my favorite Chinese restaurant in L.A., Christmas Story style. We went to Din Tai Fung in Arcadia. Great Chinese restaurant if you're ever out that way. There's only a couple of them in the whole world. The first one's in Taipei. The original. The second one was in Tokyo because the Japanese kept coming over there, flying literally just to Taipei to eat there. And the third one is in Arcadia, California. I don't know how that worked out. I don't know how that makes sense, but somehow it does, and I'm happy about it. If you're also watching on Ustream at HalSparks.com or on Ustream.tv at the Hal Sparks Hot and Sexy Cam Show, we will be able to do multiple cameras today that not only include being able to see me, but, yes, you will also be able to see Tony. That's right. Tony, our board op, is now he's going to have his own fan pages start up. Yeah, I should have told you. I should have warned Tony. He didn't have a chance to shave this morning. But I think girls like that scruffy look, Tony. I think it's going to work for you. Tony is, he's available, ladies. I'm just saying. You're going to throw that out there. Yeah, he's just sexy man. So we have a lot to cover. Obviously, the healthcare bill passed on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve and at 8 a.m. so that everybody could go home. And now the bill is in committee. And when asked, Obama said he will now be more hands-on than he has been in the entirety of the process, which I think a lot of us have been looking forward to and wondering when his engagement would actually start. I think that's the smart time to do it. Some people may disagree with me in that, and they're welcome to their opinion, although it's wrong. And I think part of the plan all the way is that he's been having to walk through this minefield of idiots. Joe Lieberman, excuse me. I had to cough there for a second. Ben Nelson. And I also have been making the case, I think for a lot of you, you understand this, that were we not to have these difficult players, the Ben Nelsons of the world, the Mary Landers, the Joe Liebermans, we wouldn't even be without them. And our focus on them, we would actually be able to recognize that the vast majority of Democrats are really pushing for solid reforms and solid health care for the American people. You've got 45 million to 60 million totally uninsured or underinsured. And then you've also got the odd part, the biggest part of this bill, I think for me personally, has been throughout, is this idea that you can pay for your insurance for your entire life. You can pay for it for 20 years straight, and then one day they can just decide, because of either a clerical error or some sort of artificial cap they put on you, that they can just dump you. And that this bill, even the worst version of this bill, solves that issue. And I think that's reason enough to pass it. It also leaves a lot of great openings. We will talk about this in the third hour today. It leaves a lot of great openings, including one element of the bill that allows for the creation of nonprofits regulated in the exchange, overseen by the government, effectively a public option, effectively creating exactly what most of us have been asking for this whole time. The question is it enough to satisfy the progressives on the left? Are they ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater? That's the standard, I guess, analogy, the baby with the bathwater one, and I would like to avoid that. I prefer to use sort of a Lethal Weapon style one, which is, I guess it would technically be Speed if I'm really going to go Hollywood on this one. Is it shoot the hostage? We have a situation where Everybody there is trying to help the hostage, except for Ben Nelson, who has a gun to its head. And we have a couple of options. And one of the biggest options that seems to be floated on the left very heavily and is shoot the hostage. Start from scratch. Then these guys have nothing to deal with. Well, you can't do that, I think. I think in this debate, in this movement, in this attempt to genuinely create something out of nothing, keep in mind, everything that everyone has been arguing about insofar as how this should go, we should just scrap this all together. We need this kind. We need specifically this kind of public option. We need specifically these kind of reforms. Every time we've done that in the past, we have ended up with nothing. Nothing. Zip. We are exactly where we are because of our own methodology. The methodology has shifted this time. Obama has taken a different approach. The deal he struck with pharma kept them out of the game. Last time around, they spilled all kinds of money into this fight, and were one of the primary movers and shakers in killing health care reform for the last 16 years. He made a deal with them temporarily, I think. I think eventually it's one of those things that the American people will cry loud enough about that we will start being able to buy generics and import drugs from other countries. And we will also step past this ridiculous commerce concept, this idea of the Ayn Randian philosophy that, you know, these businesses, they make these drugs. They pay all this money for research and development, and then, you know, the government gets to come in and negotiate a cheap price or buy generics from another country or buy drugs from Canada, and it's not fair. You're going to drive these companies out of business when they do good work in research and developing drugs for everybody, because this is the upside of good corporate business. This is when Big Pharma does their job. Well, when you really look at it, the government subsidizes most of the medical advances in this country, not just the drugs, but the technology as well. They act on these. I mean, a lot of these advances are happening at state and federally funded universities, and of course the CDC and the National Institute for Health, and all these corporations get to benefit from those. That taxpayer money that's paid out in the exact same way the military-industrial complex gets to get all these advances that the government pays for into their coffers. The government advances every piece of technology the military uses. Even though it's done through private hands, they oversee it, they fund it, they request it, they refine it. The same thing happens in the drug industry. But the drug industry has somehow gotten to walk and has gotten to parlay this myth that somehow they are these altruistic corporate entities that all they do every day is get up and try to figure out a new way to cure baldness. I mean, AIDS. I mean, you know, to find some way to cure, you know, erectile dysfunction. I mean, cancer. You know, when the truth is, if they were left up entirely to that, that's pretty much the only pills they would crank out. And we kind of know this because that's how they make a decent amount of money. That's where a lot of their money is. That and acid reflux. Basically, these are the two big drugs. If left alone, this is what the corporate drug companies would come up with. Viagra and Mylanta, basically. It would all be acid reflux, some diabetes technology, because they know it's a guaranteed moneymaker, and basically punk drugs, you know, club drugs. Viagra is basically a club drug that's just made by large corporations. I mean, they can't make ecstasy and get away with it, so they made Viagra. And apparently people are mixing them, which I don't recommend. Yeah, not good. But the point I'm trying to make is I don't want to float in this idea that, you know, the altruistic pharma, they just want to build this, and then on the other hand entirely that they're nothing but this big corporate rollover, and Obama has given away the entire thing, and there's, you know, he's just a sellout because he was smart enough to actually make a deal with these guys to keep them out of the fight long enough because he's fighting the insurance companies. One villain at a time, people. One villain at a time. The insurance companies we can't attack by being less sick. The pharmaceutical companies we can actually attack by adjusting how we live our lives a lot. And refining our ability to get generic drugs and cheaper drugs and alternative treatments where they're necessary. So that's what I'm trying to get to the point is I think this has been a fantastic game of chess so far. most games of chess look ugly twice. They look ugly in the very beginning, and they look ugly near the end. This has been classic in that regard. In the bottom half of the hour, we've got Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit, is going to be with us. And then, of course, we have guests from Think Progress coming up next hour. We're going to be dealing with a lot of these issues. I want to deal to some degree, and I will with Lee Papa at the bottom of the hour, with, of course, the terrorist update, the terrorist attack on America. That's right. On Christmas Day, how could they? On Christmas Day, a terrorist from Nigeria, who apparently got his fire pants from Yemen, flew from Amsterdam into Detroit, set a firecracker off in his underwear, and apparently tried to light layers of newspaper wrapped with black powder on his legs on fire enough to blow a plane out of the sky. And it was amazingly ineffective. Kids, if this is the best Al-Qaeda has to offer, I think we're doing okay. Secondly, the right wing could not wait one second to jump on. This is Obama's fault. This is, you know, clearly. Well, I mean, let's not, to be fair, they didn't blame Obama entirely. They didn't say it was all his fault. Jim DeMint actually blamed unionization. And of course, Joe Lieberman, who I don't know how Joe Lieberman, because he's a hawk, somehow became the voice of our military decisions. But these guys could not, the right wing could not stop quoting Joe Lieberman. And that's amazing on two fronts. One, we always know what he's going to say. And two, this time it was particularly stupid. When I come back from the break, I'll actually play some of that for you. We're going to take a break. 1-800-STEF-12 is our number. We'll be talking the insurance, terrorism, whether they combine in some way. Are the Joe Liebermans of the world scaring us into not getting health reform? Is that a form of terrorism? I think it could be. Is regular terrorism still terrorism if you and I don't get scared? We just get mad? It's a big question, and I'd like to hear from you. 1-800-STEF-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in on The Stephanie Miller Show.
It's all about fun. It's The Stephanie Miller Show.
Aldous in Madison, Wisconsin has a really good question. Aldous, you there?
Yes, Hal, I am. You know, when the first when the shoe bomber incident happened, they had to start taking off our shoes at the airport.
Right.
And now that we have the underwear bomber, we better upgrade our Hanes, man.
Absolutely.
This is Victoria's Secret's greatest dream.
You know, and mine as well. Now, I granted that there's a lack of general sexiness on some of the flights that I've been on, but I think we could probably add that to the TSA screening as well. If we don't want to see you naked, you can't get on the flight. I'm sorry.
There you go. Well, I mean, it's just like a national pantsing, you know?
Totally. Well, that may be Al-Qaeda's entire goal. Is that we want? Yeah, they can't. They're not allowed to be nude over where they are because it's societally against the way they live. But they love watching us apparently because American television is all bootlegged over there, and they all love the episodes of CSI Miami that apparently do extraordinarily well over there because there's scantily clad women running around. I think that's the goal for all of America.
It's like Get Smart's old nude bomb thing, you know?
Totally. We should rent the nude bomb before too long. Thanks for the call, Aldous. I think, you know, we cannot lose our sense of humor when things go well. We have to keep in mind that this, while was very scary, I'm sure, for the people on the plane and those involved in it, I know that Michael Moore himself was in the Detroit airport when the second plane landed with the second Nigerian on it, who locked himself in the bathroom for an hour. There was a second incident that really didn't get talked up much. Apparently that guy never got his pants lit, so it was less of an issue. But he went to the bathroom. The first guy locked himself in the bathroom for an hour. And then he came out and tried to set his crotch on fire. And then a Dutch filmmaker, their version of the Hollywood elite, jumped over three rows and punched him out and burned his hands, I guess, punching the guy in the crotch, putting the fire out. So this might be a lesson to would-be terrorists as well, that people often try to put fires out by patting them and hitting them with things. Maybe you might want to just pick a better place for it. Anyway, so there was a second incident. Both of these guys, supposedly Nigerian, wealthy. This guy, the first guy who was actually, you know, got his, you know, fired his up, as it were. This guy actually is rich. His father is a Nigerian banker who I think most of us know from Spam, how well they're doing. I said over Twitter this weekend, I was, you know, basically, I think they're mad at us because we didn't help them get their $14 million out of the bank. You know, I think it's my Spam filter's fault. So anyways, this guy is he's Muslim, so the right wing is going crazy that he should, you know, we should, it's the Muslims that, you know, caused this, and this is another clear case of a savage culture and whatnot. He's also rich, and I think the rich have caused a lot of damage too, arguably, over time, if you want to talk about the backers of World War II and that kind of thing. I mean, if you're going to make the argument that the religion is based on it, this guy went to really nice schools. His dad was a banker. He went to private schools. A lot of guys that went to private schools in the last 8 years have caused a lot of trouble. Just saying. So maybe they're equally culpable. Maybe we should be strip searching the rich when they get on. I mean, Richard Branson would be totally for it. I mean, quite frankly, if we have to go to a pantsless flying society, then clearly I'm gonna fly Virgin a lot more often, mainly because it's an ironically titled airline. Secondly, so I'll deal with this a little bit with Lee Papa in the next break. I only got a minute, but I do want to say this. So Joe Lieberman, Joe, I'm going to hold a gun to the head of healthcare because I don't really care about America's families. His big response to this terrorist threat, what was his big response? We've got to attack Yemen. We have to preemptively strike against Yemen. This is important. Well, guess what, kids? We have been for 2 weeks. That's what we've been doing for the last month. We've been providing material support and weapons and money to the Yemeni government to attack al-Qaeda. And these two guys are more than likely a direct response to that policy. We will be right back after this with Lee Papa, the Root Pundit. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12. We'll be taking your calls. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in on this lovely Monday morning. You hear a little Easy O. This is a Japanese metal band, Easy O, produced by Gene Simmons. You can kind of hear it. They're awesome. This is totally obscure and off topic, but we've got Lee Pop on, so I don't want to keep him waiting. We'll talk Easy O more in the next break. Oh, we'll bring it back in the next hour because that's a great story behind that. Online with me right now, I'm lucky enough to have the Rude Pundit himself, Lee Papa. It's rudepundit.blogspot.com.
That's it.
Thank you. See? Look at that.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. I would love to hear more about Japanese metal.
Dude. But... Well, I mean, you have to know about loudness. I, you know, jokingly referred to as roudness in the 80s one of the most amazing speed guitar players ever. And one of the greatest videos where, during their song Let It Go, they show a tree being cut down in the beginning of the video, and then the log being dragged down a hill, and then the being refined into a chunk of wood. And then by the time he gets to the solo, it becomes a guitar that comes off an assembly line. He literally picks it up off the assembly line and starts soloing. It's beautiful.
That's just badass.
It's stunning. Obviously, you and I probably this time last week thought that, you know, this Monday we would be talking about nothing but healthcare. And then this terrorist quote, and I say that with air quotes, which you can watch on the Ustream feed, this terrorist act happens, and then everybody rolls into their standard playbook.
Yeah, I just want to know how this guy who got through security in Amsterdam, how that actually reflects poorly on American terrorist
right.
security.
Yeah, why is the TSA, you know, Jim DeMint was saying that the unionization of TSA is the problem. But this guy didn't cross through those people at all.
No, he crossed through. You know what it must be is they got lazy because of their universal health care over there.
That's true. They take everything for granted, you know,
That's
because
right.
they're a welfare state.
Yeah, so everybody
yeah.
must be cool.
Yeah.
And it's the dope, too.
Totally.
Everybody was stoned with universal health care in Amsterdam and is like, dude, just come on.
Well, clearly his idea of an incendiary device was to wrap his legs in rolling papers because that's essentially
a crotch rocket.
Yeah, exactly. He made just a lap bong, basically.
Yeah.
Like, you know, anybody from Amsterdam probably just looked like he was trying to smoke his underwear, which, you know, seemed semi-normal.
Yeah, you know, when you're desperate, you'll try to make anything into a bong.
Will you? I'll take your word for it. I'm straight edge, so I live in a blissful ignorance away from that. But
I just love the idea that this guy had to jump three rows. The Dutch director had to jump three rows to put. What were the other people doing? Did they just go, oh, that must just be the flaming junk of Nigerians that, you know, it happens? Every
yeah,
now
exactly.
And then.
Sometimes their crotches burst into flame. It's, you know, it's something, you know, they have to deal with as a culture.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a rite of passage. Maybe he's a man now. That kind of idea.
Yes. Once you get punched repeatedly in your flaming crotch, you are now a man in
right.
Nigeria.
That's true. I mean, if that doesn't make you feel like a man, you know, what will, quite frankly?
Yeah.
So then, of course, there was a second fellow who, even less effective, never got his underwear lit.
Now, I heard that, has there been any updates since it was just, no, he was just really sick and happened to be Nigerian?
Right.
And
all I know is, they haven't cleared all that up, but that wouldn't surprise me at all. It would be really sad to have, you know, if you had Montezuma's Revenge, you stopped off in Amsterdam and got a meal your body wasn't used to, and you're just happening to fly into Detroit.
That's right. That's it.
That's bad timing.
Because one would think that at that point the security would have been beefed up in Amsterdam. And,
right.
That was the last I heard about that one, was that this guy just was, they were trying to get him to come out of the bathroom, and he was yelling and cursing at them.
Right.
Which is what you do if you were, you know, busy in there and somebody kept pounding on the door.
Right, exactly. If your butt was mad at you.
Yes.
For something your mouth did. I get what you're saying. Well, and that's the thing. We're all, you know, it's the one bad apple situation, you know, and where we as a society, now we're all going to have to be, you know, I don't mind the crotch frisk, quite frankly. No.
If you want to delicately pat my crotch before I enter your airport, have at.
That's great. You know what? We look back in history at all these really strange social norms in a lot of the old societies. You know how, you know, some societies shake hands with their left because of what they do with their right normally.
Mm-hmm.
And those kind of things. And just, you know, the kissing on either cheek or the knocking of, you know, the saying cheers and knocking your drinks together was because if the other guy had poisoned your beverage, some of yours would splash into his and he wouldn't dare drink it. And you could tell, you know, so, the, you know, these kind of by the, you know, 200 years from now, it will be a greeting when you get on any kind of, you know, flying device, because I don't necessarily think it'll be planes, where they'll go, hello, welcome to Virgin, you know, space pod, and then they'll just lightly touch your crotch, tap you on either shoulder, and bang your drinks together, and then you'll get on the plane.
That's it. It'll start with the ceremonial putting on of the rubber gloves. And
right. This is how cultures begin. This is the beginning of American culture. That's what this is. This is how chopsticks started.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be websites devoted to it as a fetish. People who try to go through security and even put things in their crotch just so it has to be discovered.
Oh, yeah. I've already started crotch patch, you can't even say it, crotchpat.org. Just nonprofit. I think it's very important that it be nonprofit.
People will be filming it. It'll be the next big masturbation trend.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, you've also, I'm certain that you have seen the new X-ray machines that create this kind of claymation nude of you.
Yes.
Which is really disturbing and grotesque, but that Richard Clark and a lot of other people are going, well, that's just kind of what we're going to need to have, because that's what would have stopped this guy. The puffers would have worked as well, but they're actually more expensive.
Yeah, and I wasn't the puffer actually down? And I think that was actually one of the problems, is the puffer was
well,
down.
Well, wouldn't the puffer always be down?
That's true.
I mean,
that's
really, because let's be honest, most of the detection devices that have been put forth in airport security over the last few decades have not been about bombs, they've been about drugs. The questions they used to ask, did you pack this bag yourself, did you leave it with anybody, you're carrying anything for anyone, was not about bombs, because what the hell does that good does that questioning do you if the bomb goes off the plane? But if you bust a guy for drugs later, he already answered the three questions in essentially a pre-Mirandized admission of guilt. He said, yeah, because what do those guys always say? I didn't pack this bag. My friend Dave, that's his stash.
Right.
I just carried this on for some. I left my bag and somebody must have stuffed that in. Well, if you've already walked up to the counter and said, I packed this bag myself, I'm not carrying anything for anyone else, and it's been in my possession at all times, then later on when the cops bust you for having weed in your bag, you can't legitimately claim that because people were walking away. So most of the puffer, I think, probably catches weed dust more than it.
See, I always made those questions in my mind. I made it more of a James Bond thing and thought, oh, they're checking for microfilm.
Right. No. Now they take your laptop if you're from the wrong country.
That's
right. And then they just copy everything because they want your porn, and then they give it back to you. And kind of after holding.
Oh, they don't want my porn.
No, they don't. Oh, that's sad. They always seem to want mine, but that's why I put it. That's why I carry it. Like I go, you don't have to go through my laptop. It's all on one of those little mini USB drives.
Here,
just plug it right in, and I'll even tell you which ones. I can look at you and tell you what you'll like of it. You won't like all of it, but you might like this, dude. I can tell you're
you're a total stump porn fanatic.
Absolutely, yeah. You love you remind me of my friend Tim Kern, the tattoo artist, and that's totally where you would go. Or my dear friend on Twitter, Mistress Varla, who's a CBT and is actually a hardcore dominatrix. You know,
yeah.
If I can see it in your eyes, if you'd be friends with her. So, but the amazing thing,
what are we talking about?
Where were we? Terrorism.
About the leather straps rubbing your skin and
right. But I think that I think we have moved to a certain the British at one point post World War II, and the fact that London had been bombed to shreds, developed a sort of gallows humor about the whole thing. And that ended up being very healthy and helping them kind of heal through it. And I think that's sort of where we are in a lot of ways. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, we have to. And, if they keep giving us material, like blowing up your crotch to try to blow up
right.
the plane.
Yeah.
I like to think that that's Al-Qaeda's little gift to us.
Yeah.
Okay, you know what? Frankly, if this guy's Al-Qaeda, I'm a regular on MSNBC.
Seriously.
Seriously.
By the way, you should be. But
thank you. So should you.
Thanks.
Mutual compliment society.
We'll do a team thing on Rachel's show sometime. It'll be great. We'll come on as, we'll have one of those sweaters with two head holes cut in it,
That's great. We'll tag team on Rachel. That's great.
Excellent way to look at it. So the point I'm trying to make, and we should actually take a break. Should we take a break so we can still have, because I want to have some more time with you.
Sure, let's go for
it. We're going to take a break. I'm on the air with Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. It's rudepundit.blogspot.com. Check that out during the break. We will be right back after this.
Kid tested. John Conyers approved. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. StephanieMiller.com is the website for all information on Steph. You can see pictures of her dogs. You can get a window into her life as much as she'll allow. She certainly won't allow the show to be Ustreamed like I've been doing all week, so get it while you can, I suppose. On the line with me still is the fantastic, the lovely, the talented Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit, who is amazingly, I have to say, gracious as a human being. I know you like to go by the Rude Pundit, but quite frankly, comparatively, considering the David Brookses of the world, I think you're quite lovely to deal with.
Oh, well, thank you.
Perhaps it's an ironic title.
You see, that I get that a lot, but the thing is there are people to be rude to.
And I agree.
People to not be.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, I appreciate that I'm somehow on the better side of that receiving.
I feel like some kind of, you know, whiskey drinking Santa saying that.
Right. Well, I, you know, that's how you strike me.
Oh, that, you know what? That's the way most days I feel when I'm writing.
Right. So this obviously, you know, this overtook largely the healthcare debate over the weekend. I mean, that really it allowed the Republicans were looking for something after their major loss on Christmas Eve, because they really did pack it up and go home. You know, they were all like, we're going to stay to the bitter end. By bitter end, we mean Thursday at 8 a.m.
Yeah.
And they're hoping that this, you know, this guy setting his underwear on fire is their new 9/11 that they can parlay into.
Which isn't it great? You know, terrorist attack under Bush, we all of us come together and unify.
Mm-hmm.
And terrorist attack under Obama, it's you bastard. We're gonna, you know, destroy your presidency again.
Sure. Well, where's the 1226 movement? That's what I'm starting.
That's right.
I want to start the 1226 movement. Where were we the day after the pants bomber? Well, I want to get back to where we were as people.
The day after the pants
day
bomber
after,
failed.
Right. Exactly. When we were all unified at the mall. Returning our gifts that didn't fit.
Yes, that's right.
That's all, where I want us to get to.
All wondering where I can get a pants bomb for
exactly.
My time in Kohl's.
Yeah, my grandmother misjudged my size again.
I'm not advocating bombing Kohl's.
No, they do lovely work if you need slacks.
Yes, if
it's one of the few places.
You need discount Sansa belts? That's where you got to go.
Right, exactly. Can't go wrong with the one of the few stores that still carry kids, I think. You know, but so yeah. So this is what we're up against. We've got Joe Lieberman. His immediate response was, "The United States must preemptively attack Yemen. We've got to attack."
Didn't we go into Iraq so we could fight them over there?
Right.
So did they just shift over a country? Is that is this what we're doing?
Yeah.
We're playing like playing a game where we're like pounding down something under a rug that just lumps up somewhere else.
That's precisely it. It's the permanent wrinkle in the sheet that you just have to deal with eventually and go to bed.
And that's not to say that Al Qaeda was ever in Iraq. I mean, that's
right. No, they were actually specifically not in Iraq.
Right.
They were actually, that was one of the places they were having a hard time getting a stranglehold on the country before Bush went, well, this would be a great idea. It's just,
yeah.
There's a lot of nice oil fields.
And I bet we could have coordinated and pumped up security all around the world.
Yep.
If we hadn't spent all of our money on a really, really bad investment.
Exactly. And spent our energy chasing down a phantom where it did not exist in the first place. Interestingly enough, like I said, I said this before you came on with us, and I don't know if you said this, but right after, you know, Pete Hoekstra came out and said, this is because Obama is dropping the ball on Yemen. He has not been paying enough attention to Yemen, even though he mentioned it in his, national security speech,
right.
Specifically. But in the last 2 weeks, just over the last 2 weeks, and I'll read this to you, it's like, Yemeni security forces carried out airstrikes and ground raids against suspected al-Qaeda hideouts over the past 2 weeks with what American officials described as intelligence and firepower supplied by the United States. The assaults were Yemen's widest offensive against the jihadists in years. President Obama reportedly personally approved the use of military hardware, intelligence, and other support to Yemeni forces in their assault on al-Qaeda. So it looks to me like these two little mini attacks are the weakened Yemeni al-Qaeda's attempt at reprisal.
And it's just strange that, you know, that the way Obama's approach was to, I don't know, support the people in the country that oppose al-Qaeda and understand that maybe the country doesn't want them there.
Right.
And
John Bolton's plan, of course, is that we should, make sure that they've all got American flags on their packs, on their bags, on their shoulders, so that when we're fighting these people, they think it's simply the United States who's against them. This is part of the problem with unilateralism, the idea that America is pushing its agenda, and we're this go-it-alone, we're going to go-it-alone kind of idea, is the problem is it creates a single reverse target that everybody you're fighting against, which is a bunch of different groups in a bunch of different countries, masquerading as Al-Qaeda because we gave them that name. They didn't come up with it on their own, per se.
Right.
They get to go, well, our one enemy in the West is the United States. This is our big enemy, and this is what we're going to focus on. And but Obama's plan is, you know, basically using power in alignment with the actual governments of the countries and go, look, we're not here to crush you guys. We want to keep you guys safe as well. The whole world needs to know that these guys are the bad guys, and we will help you take care of it. And not just bomb your schools by accident, say, oops,
yeah.
You know, we'll provide you with material assistance and satellite photos.
So you can bomb your own schools, and we don't get the blame.
Right. Well, that's apparently in the Yemen situation, that hasn't been the case, thank God.
Yeah,
But in Afghanistan, that was part of our early problem.
Right. The biggest problem for Republicans on this is they just so blanketly accuse anybody who with a Middle Eastern sounding name. What was it? I have this quote from Peter King from New York, who said 100% of the Islamic terrorists are Muslims, which he's the Yogi Berra of the Congress.
Sure,
now.
But this is also the do you think they know it's Christmas time kind of attitude.
Right.
The French don't have a word for entrepreneur. that's a running meme with them. They're just this constant lack of awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the failure, you know, it's like all of a sudden Yemen's on the radar. It's the new thing that they can start trotting out, and now there's somebody, you know, there's a new radical sheik with a scary sounding name,
right.
Al-Awlaki, and we can, because Osama bin Laden's lost his punch.
Yeah, by dying 2 years ago, apparently,
yeah.
According to the French and the Algerians, and he's been dead for 3 years.
Oh, God.
By the way, which I think would be a good plan, if you want to talk about positive military strategy, you've got somebody like Osama bin Laden who's waiting to be martyred,
right.
Then what you do is you kill him and you go, I don't know where he is, and you spend the next 2 years looking for him even though he's already dead, and then he fades off at the end of it. You wouldn't come out and go, we got him, he's dead.
Right.
That would be the stupidest thing you could possibly do. And I think that's true of a lot of these things, but, you know, these guys have such an erection for, you know, this kind of, this bloodlust.
Mm-hmm. Although it is kind of a wacky comedy of, you know, carrying around the corpse of Osama bin Laden to bring out and scare people every now and then.
Oh, that I totally agree with. But from just a strictly military strategy idea that you've got, you've got a guy that you have to deal with who, if you do kill him and claim it, then all of his followers will just, it'll just renew them for a while. The best thing to do is kill him in secret and walk away like nothing happened.
The other thing is, you know, there's also this notion in, I think, in America that if we get him, then that will solve everything, which is,
again, that's our pill mentality. Yeah. That's we don't want an exercise program. We want a pill that gives us abs.
Right. It's our movie mentality too, that, you know, if you
somehow it wraps up at the end.
Yep. Yep.
But, we gotta take a break. Lee Papa, rudepundit.blogspot.com. Fantastic work. Always great to have you on.
Same
Look forward
here.
To talking to you in the future. And take care. Have a great new year, man.
You too.
Yeah. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEF-12 is our number. We will be back at the top of the hour with Andrea. Let's see. Who's coming in? Amanda Turkle is going to be with us. StephanieMiller.com is the website. We'll be back.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. StephanieMiller.com. I'm, of course, streaming live on Ustream.tv at the Hal Sparks Hot and Sexy Cam Show. And, of course, on HalSparks.com, you can go to the Ustream page on there. Follow me on Twitter at Hal Sparks, and you can also join in the chat room on Ustream or at my site at HalSparks.com. We're continuing the conversation not only about healthcare, but, of course, terrorism in quotes, the new face of Al-Qaeda, or the new crotch of Al-Qaeda. I don't know how we're going to put it right. Maybe perhaps we'll get some legitimate perspective. I have to, you know, take my silly hat off that I've been to with Lee Papa for a little bit, because I'm lucky enough to have Amanda Turkle on the line. She's the Deputy Research Director and Managing Editor for ThinkProgress.org and The Progress Report. How are you, Amanda?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely, my pleasure. It's good to talk to you. I'm a fan of your writing. I really dig thinkprogress.org. I think you guys do some fantastic work. You seem to get, in a lot of cases, it's very helpful when you're doing radio, the sound bites that kind of resonate the argument the best, I think. Whether it's dealing with what people have been saying about the terrorist attack or healthcare lately, those kind of things. I also, your article on the Ugandan official saying on gays that killing them might not be helpful, life imprisonment might be better, was a standout as well. Stunning, just stunning. And, of course, your work on Sarah Palin is unprecedented, I think. So I would like to get your take on, of course, both the passage of the healthcare bill in the Senate and the movement there, the committee movement, and of course this wonderful throwback to the days of yore with terrorism. We're like, oh, remember terrorism? Yeah, I forgot all about that for a while because we've been so caught up in all this stuff, and here comes this guy setting his pants on fire.
Well, on healthcare, I think it was great news that it passed the Senate. Mm-hmm. I know that the bill is not perfect. I don't think any progressives would say it's perfect, mm-hmm. And certainly no conservatives are saying it's perfect, especially considering that not a single Republican voted for the bill.
Right.
Even though they said over and over that they were negotiating in good faith and wanted health care reform just as much as any Democrat. But
right.
We definitely didn't see them negotiating at all. They basically said from day one that their mantra was going to be just say no.
Right.
And they were hoping that the American public basically would get so frustrated at how chaotic the process is that they would just eventually in the next election cycle vote out all the Democrats and put Republicans in. And so that's basically what they were going for, was just trying to be as obstructionist as possible. But so the fact that it did get through the Senate and that Harry Reid was able to marshal the 60 votes needed to pass it, despite all the egos of the many senators who all demanded their own thing in the bill, I think that was great news. And hopefully the final bill may have some of the more progressive elements in it that we don't like to see.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I've been a big fan all along of getting it to committee. I recognize, one of the points I've been making is that we wouldn't be talking about the Ben Nelsons of the world. We wouldn't be talking about the Joe Liebermans if the rest of the Democrats weren't legitimately trying to create a decent bill. Without their obstruction, we would have already had this taken care of, which says to me that the vast majority of Democrats are really working towards progressive legislations on a lot of fronts, and the Republicans, with a few conservative, in quotes, Democrats, are trying to do everything but that. And I think that's a much more important distinction to be made than what I think the agenda that the Republicans have, like you stated, that where people are, they're trying to get people frustrated and just hate the whole process and that's it. So they check out.
I absolutely agree with you. I think, right, like you said, the fact that Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson and these few senators have had so much power is because progressive senators have been willing to say, I have a lot of pet issues too. This bill's not perfect, but I'm going to put those aside because I recognize that ensuring more Americans and getting comprehensive health care reform is more important than my own personal agenda.
Right.
Unfortunately, the few quote unquote moderate senators or conservative Democrats haven't been willing to do that, and they've been putting their personal agenda over the best interest. Ultimately, luckily, they did end up voting for the bill, which was a great move by them, and I was happy to see that.
Right. And there was, I think it was at the top of the page today, somebody asked McConnell, I think it was, if he thought it would be, the Republicans would run in 2010 on repealing health care reform if it did indeed pass. And he passed on answering. meaning that I think that they're aware that even as flawed as this bill is, once it passes, the changes that will be made because of it will be too popular with the American people. That you know, all this, you know, wringing of hands and gnashing of teeth will go by the wayside, and once it gets passed, and people will really start to think this is a positive.
That's absolutely right. I mean, they kept saying that the public option is so bad it's going to destroy the country, but then they were afraid that every American would want into the public option and would realize how great it was. So there's always been a contradiction there. The same thing happened with Medicare. When Medicare was being proposed, conservatives were saying that it's socialized medicine, government-run medicine will destroy the country. The same things they're saying now. It's been passed. It's a very popular government program. And now no conservative pretty much is willing to say that they will take a stand and run on a platform of repealing Medicare. Senior citizens tend to like Medicare. I think congressmen like Medicare. And so once it's passed, they basically know that they lost, which is why they've been trying so hard to obstruct it in the first place.
Right. In some cases, you almost feel like voting for, because they're so against it, that's almost reason enough to support it. Because obviously they're seeing something in it long term that maybe we're even missing. That, you know, for example, one of the things that was brought up on Think Progress that I think was missed in a bunch of other places was this ability in the exchange for there to be nonprofits created and overseen by a government agency, which effectively would be similar to a public option. And certainly leave the option in the, you know, the possibility in the future for a public option to be built.
I think that is absolutely true. As many senators and Obama himself have said, this is not going to be the last word on health care reform.
Right.
At least I hope it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But if nothing is passed now, I mean, think how long it's been since we last attempted health care reform. You know, it's going to be another decade. Hopefully this is passed. You know, there may be problems with it. There
right.
most likely will be, and those can continue to be tweaked. We can continue to make the healthcare system more progressive. So we need to pass this bill, and then we can make changes.
Right.
Keeping the status quo and doing nothing, as Joe Lieberman has actually said he would like to do, it just isn't going to be a solution.
No. Well, we'll just always go back to zero. We, you know, our methodology has gotten us exactly where we are. Correct? I mean, everything that a lot of those people are advocating for, the getting rid of the bill, starting from scratch, blah, 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 that's actually where we've been for the last 60 years, 80 years. You know, we haven't moved past this point because we haven't taken this first step. Once we take this first step, it opens the door for a lot of the reforms that a lot of us think are necessary. But there's this mentality of sort of shoot the hostage, because, you know, if Lieberman and Nelson are holding the person, you know, holding the bill hostage, we should just kill it and move back, you know, and start from scratch and do this through reconciliation. That idea, when I think a lot of that thought has been put out. I think Harry Reid and Obama actually did have this kind of, will that work? Will we be able to pull that off? And I think their answer kept being no, so they went, okay, how do we make this happen and start delivering?
Absolutely. I mean, actually, it's funny. If you listen to Orrin Hatch, his suggestion is to just give power back to the Republicans, and then the whole health care
right.
crisis will
Because
be
that
fixed.
Works
so
the last 8 years,
they
sure.
They did nothing at all while they did hold power in both branches of in both the executive branch and the legislative branch.
Right. Yeah, the new GI Bill was a direct response to the fact that Democrats took power in the House and Senate and started pushing the progressive ideas through again. If that had not happened, the Republicans would have never come up with that on their own. If they were still in power currently, there is no way any of these reforms in any form at all would be on the table. The Lilly Ledbetter Act would not have been signed. There would not be the first Hispanic woman on the Supreme Court. There would clearly not have been a stimulus package, and then the money from that's being paid back from TARP would have gone to tax cuts instead of into a jobs program, which is what Obama is suggesting.
Absolutely. That's why they earned the nickname of the Do Nothing Congress.
Right. Because they had no interest in doing anything. They were, you know, basically what they wanted to do was dismantle things that had been done. And that was their idea of activity. You know, and I think they see nothing wrong with that. That actually to them is a political philosophy. Is destructive politics. The idea of tearing it down. The Grover Norquist idea of, you know, you want a government so small you could drown it in a bathtub.
Exactly. I mean, that's what they're now trying to do with when they're in the minority, too.
Right. Right. Which is, Tom Harkin actually just said he's going to reintroduce his legislation to kill the filibuster, to limit the filibuster. It's funny that they use that language because on Huffington Post it says Tom Harkin may reintroduce legislation to kill filibuster. The legislation really says is to limit it to a month. That they actually have to actively filibuster, or they can do a non-verbal filibuster hold on stuff for a month to increase debate. But they can't just stop it anymore.
That'll be interesting to see if that passes, because
right.
I know each party, many senators in each party would like to have the filibuster tool at its disposal.
Totally.
When it's in the minority. But the filibuster hasn't always been the tool of the minority. That's really come about. That basically came about during the Clinton years when it really had a big impact on what was going on and where, you know, the entire minority party would basically use that as the main tool of obstructing legislation instead of putting out proposals. They just used the filibuster. And so it's a relatively recent development. And I think increasingly people are looking at it and saying, okay, I don't think that the filibuster was used to hold up every piece of legislation. So it will be interesting to see how many senators really want to take a hard look at that and maybe revise Senate rules.
Right. Well, ultimately, I think a lot of us are very confused, and I think as a citizenry, very confused the idea that a filibuster where you don't actually have to filibuster has been used for quite some time, that the rules have been changed so much that just the idea that I want to talk on the floor for the next 25 hours in a row, it should be enough. I shouldn't have to actually do it. I should just say I'm going to do it, and that's the equivalent of doing it. That, I think, is a bit strange. I think a lot of us are going, well, no, I think if you're going to say I need time to make my case, which is what a filibuster is legitimately for, then you should stand there and make your case until your case is made, until you either change everybody's mind because they're amazed at your argument, or they tell you to sit down and shut up because you're just making the same stupid point over and over again. But they've eliminated that part of it. It's very strange.
I agree. I think when we teach kids now how a bill becomes a law, you were always taught, if a majority votes, then the bill passes. I think you need now to revise that and say, well, in the Senate now, you need 60 votes.
Right, right. And that's not even to pass the bill. That's to stop the almost automatic filibuster of any contentious piece of legislation. It seems to be largely a waste of time and of energy and intellect in the Senate. You know, when there seem to be so many problems, this is what you're going to spend your time. None of them are coming up with here's my solid alternate solution, especially in the Republican Party. Because the truth is they don't want a solution. They don't want government involved in anything. They just want to kill it, and that's the end of it. They just don't want it to exist. So you can't have a substantive back-and-forth argument weighing the best options or the best possibilities in any kind of issue, which there are a lot of, by the way. I think there are legitimate arguments across the spectrum of philosophical thought. I won't say right and left or conservative and liberal, but there are legitimate conversations to be had on a lot of topics. But you can't have one with the Republicans these days because they're not interested in it working out at all. They just want it gone. And so you can't say, we need to help take care of these people because you're dead at the premise. They don't actually agree with the premise that we need to help everybody. They don't see that as a genuine place to start from. I got to take a break, but can you stick around through the next break with me?
Sure.
If you have time, that would be great. I'm Hal Sparks. We're filling in. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We'll get to your calls at the bottom of the hour. For the next little bit, I'm going to be continue to talk to Amanda Turkle. She's Deputy Research Director and Managing Editor for ThinkProgress.org and a wonderful human being. We'll be right back after this. I'm Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Coming up after this commercial, I will be talking even louder.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph Oh, by the way, this is me singing and playing guitar. This is my band, Zero One, available on iTunes. It's true. Very proud of it. New album coming out end of February. If we can get it done by then, I'm keeping my fingers crossed, but I think we will. We'll be all right. In physical form, it might take a little longer to get it on iTunes. But I digress. Still on the line with me, thankfully, I have Amanda Turkel from Think Progress. Are you there, Amanda? You still with me?
I am.
Excellent. So we clearly have a stonewall methodology with Republicans. Hands down, this is all they care about. And the reason is because they know that any even small progress has lasting results. They've built their entire empire, as it were, the way they've gotten their, you know, their roots into almost every part of the government is by making long-term, small, incremental change. I think the Supreme Court being in solidly conservative hands for three decades has, you know, is a good example of that. And I think that's the lesson our side needs to learn, especially in the healthcare debate. Would you agree?
I mean, I think that's an interesting lesson. And you mentioned the Supreme Court, that many people say that's actually what Chief Justice John Roberts is now trying to do. If you look at a lot of his cases, they aren't grand conservative changes. They tend to be very small, step-by-step pieces, but he is leading the country in a more conservative direction.
Right.
So I think there is something to what you're saying there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, and I think we've only got about a minute and a half left. I want to make sure that everybody gets to check out thinkprogress.org. Your writings have also been in the New York Times, Politico, Salon, Daily Beast. I'm a fan of your work, and I think people would be greatly served to go to thinkprogress.org and check out the site on a regular basis and your work. What do you think going forward, just with 1 minute left, do you think the bill coming out of committee will satisfy the progressives enough to get the votes and get the support?
I think it will satisfy lawmakers enough to get their support. I think there will be many people outside of Congress within mm-hmm. the progressive community who may still be unhappy mm-hmm. with the bill, but I'm hoping, I mean, I would love to be proven wrong on that and that the bill does come out to be sufficiently progressive enough that everyone is pleased, but that may not happen.
Right. I understand that. Thank you so much, Amanda Turkel, thinkprogress.org. Appreciate you being with us today, and I appreciate your sense of perspective. Have a great new year.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. Bye. So I'm Al Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12. We'll be right back after this. The Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number, and I am here to remind you that you can still rock in America. That's really excellent choice, Tony. No question. On the line, I have Julian Wong, senior policy analyst. Julian, are you there?
Hey, I'm here. How are you doing?
From AmericanProgress.org. Are you still in Copenhagen? Are you back?
No, I am in back in the U.S.
Oh, fantastic. Are you New York-based, so you've actually gotten some sleep?
I'm actually based in Washington, so where all the action happens. You
it's
know?
True, right. Or is stopped from happening, as the case may be, in the case of Republican obstructionism.
Exactly.
And by the way, Shinny and Kuala, since that's coming up this
Shinny.
Week.
Hey,
Bukachi. Anyways, so... Now, you've going through that, by the way, going through the, you know, sort of the Copenhagen talks and then coming back to Washington, do you see any kind of progress being made in that area? Did it seem to lead to anything in your mind? Is it, you know, the first step that we thought it would, we'd hoped it would be, and that there will actually, because there's supposed to be follow-ups, are there not, to this regional
base? Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, first off, I will say that, you know, we could have been in a completely different situation depending on what the last, you know, 12 or 18 hours of Copenhagen transpired. You know, certainly the day before it wasn't looking too good. It didn't seem like there was going to be anything that was going to come out of the whole summit itself, and we were really looking at possibly looking at a complete breakdown. Thankfully, what came out of it in the end was a short but helpful and constructive document that sets the pathway for further action, that creates a sort of a 5-week deadline for countries to submit their pledges, commitments, and there'll certainly be ongoing, you know, certainly the talks will continue on a regular basis, to try to work towards a legally binding treaty. In terms of what the reaction was back home, it's been mixed, you know, certainly as of anything else, you know, you'll have the detractors, you know, who say that, you know, nothing was legally binding, but we knew that. You know, the thing is, we knew that, you know, the objective wasn't to get a legally binding treaty. It didn't look like it was going to be realistic going into it. I think what was important is that we have, like, sort of like the step one of a two-step process, getting a political commitment to work towards a legally binding treaty. And I think in large part, we achieved most of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. One of the issues, I think, in a lot of ways is, you know, are all these essentially, once we start getting, you know, people to the table, then everyone has to go home and kind of assess what they're capable of actually changing without crashing their economies, without, you know, and by the way, in some cases may actually be able to commit to more than they thought based on the standards and the principles that everybody has set forth.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that is certainly the hope, you know. But, you know, I guess the flip side of it is the way these things go generally. If you talk about these sort of commitments, these top line commitments to curb emissions, on the one hand, I like to think that, you know, countries can go back and reflect and think about how they can improve their targets. On the other hand, you know, it is also true that the targets that they have committed already has been a result of much deliberation and reflection.
Right.
So in that regard, it remains to be seen how flexible countries will be. I think what is going to be important, I think, going forward is to find some sort of alternative process to the UN process. As we see, like, it's just so difficult to get consensus amongst 193 nations. And so there's now talk of putting together a smaller group of nations using existing channels such as the G20, for instance. You know, and if you look at these 20 nations, if you add up all the emissions, they account for some 85% of global emissions. So that could be a more constructive forum, getting the top 20 or so emitting countries and maybe hashing out improved deal among these countries. I think that could be helpful.
That's
while bearing in mind the interests of the other countries that are not represented, of course.
Right, that's true. But you know, if we solved you know, our own issues as the larger, more polluting countries, clearly that does a lot more than, you know, trying to squeeze a much bigger commitment out of a smaller country with less of an impact. You know, if we and China and India and Russia and the European Union as a whole and the like can do a major shift, you know, a 20% drop in our a 5% drop in our output of pollution is equivalent to 100% of everyone else in the world nearly just because of the volume. So
right.
The question then becomes, is it really now that the governments have gotten in line, they're kind of coming home to, you know, almost as you would with states that have come to, you know, like governors and senators who've gone to Washington, and now they've got to come back to their states and see if their constituents are for it or against it. This is actually the time more than ever for, I think, people who are anti-pollution and pro environment to really start making their case to their representatives at home, so that when Obama presents, you know, the American side of things, he can be more far-reaching and feel like he has the support of the citizenry more so than ever.
That's absolutely right. You know, I think if anything came out of Copenhagen, I think it was the outpouring of public support globally for climate action. If, you know, even though the final outcome outcome was less than desired. Mm-hmm. I think that public, you know, support, you know, have you seen the streets of Copenhagen, just a lot of rallies,
right.
I think is an important, you know, symbolism, and hopefully that translates, you know, just in terms of the United States, translates back home as well. And that's going to be important because I think if senators and congressmen can see that, that there is strong public support for this, mm-hmm. That is going to make it much more likely that they're going to support a domestic climate bill.
Right. And I, you know, like I've been advocating for quite some time for, you know, a more pollution oriented approach, since we've run up against a wall in the climate change aspect with certain people but nobody, all sorts of people, there's almost religious backing for not believing in climate change for some people, but nobody seems to argue with pollution being bad, and the more it poisons our groundwater and our air and our children, the worse it is. And so I think there's a case to be made in this country from an environmental standpoint that we all stand by that lowering our auto emissions, lowering the chemicals that factories put out into the environment, either through stricter EPA regulations or through cap and trade, are legitimate ways of protecting our own health. Whether you believe in climate change or not is immaterial, almost. And I think what you end up with is a policy base where the president can go back and go, this is what we're doing in regard to climate change, and it's all being affected by our sort of acting locally kind of attitude.
I think articulating the case for action on climate change in terms of the co-benefits is going to be very important.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've identified one of the key co-benefits, mm-hmm. of climate action, that is that by controlling carbon, more often than not, you're also controlling other pollutants,
mm-hmm.
That come with the burning of fossil fuels. So the public health benefit is very strong.
Right.
I think also what the president has been trying to do is also articulate the co-benefit of economic competitiveness. So, you know, in that we are actually innovating and creating clean energy technologies, and to the
right.
extent that the world enters into an understanding that, you know, carbon is going to be a commodity and it has to be regulated, then there's going to be a global market for these clean energy technologies.
Right.
And so this could really enhance the economy and create new jobs and enhance the economic competitiveness of the United States.
Absolutely. Can you hang on for a bit? And I want to go and I need to take a break real quick.
Sure.
Are we good, Tony?
Yeah,
we should take a break. And I want to come back. I'm with, talking with Julian Wong from AmericanProgress.org. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller. We're talking climate change, pollution, and health care by just natural follow of logic. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'll get to your calls a little bit in the bottom of the hour, and we'll be right back after this. Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. StephanieMiller.com. I'm streaming live on HalSparks.com or on Ustream.tv. If you're a regular Ustream subscriber, you can go to the Hal Sparks Hot and Sexy Cam Show on there because I couldn't think of a better name. And, of course, you can follow me on Twitter, Hal Sparks. I know it's cryptic, but it works. On the line with me from AmericanProgress.org, I'm lucky enough to have senior policy analyst Julian Wong. Julian, you there?
Yes, I am.
Good. So I think, you know, we've been talking a little bit of, sort of about in the – by the way, you have some great articles that I want to remind people that they can actually take a look at. One is from December 7th, America's Serious About Climate Action, and the announcement of U.S.-China cooperation to create a path to Copenhagen success. These are all on AmericanProgress.org. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
Excellent. So people can go over there and check those out, and I think they'd be – it'd be valuable to do so. I think, obviously, as China emerges as an enormous, you know, as the middle class grows there and their consumption base rises, you're going to see that reflected in the amount of pollution put out. There's just no way around it. that there's going to be an impact from a group of people that didn't have money and didn't have means before suddenly having money and means. And it will be equivalent to, in a lot of ways, the what America went through during the Industrial Revolution and post-World War II, where we had an entire generation of people coming up getting TVs, getting cars, getting personal electronics and radios and those kind of things. And all these elements have, you know, have an imprint, have a pollution imprint and the like. And I know that in some ways China is actually doing more work to stem that than we did. Can you speak to some of that and just what they're taking care of? Because, like, they just unveiled their the fastest train in the world,
I believe,
last week.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, I'm glad you brought up China, because if I can make another shameless plug,
sure.
I also have a blog especially on China environment and energy issues at greenleapforward.com.
Greenleapforward.com. We'll put that on the StephanieMiller.com.
Thank you. So, you know, I think absolutely. I think, you know, when you look at China, is an interesting creature. I mean, it's a country of contradictions, and in large part that's because it's undergoing this massive transition period. You know, it has, you know, since its opening up in reform in 1979, you know, it undertook, you know, two decades worth of really unabated economic expansion. But very quickly, they realized that, you know, the old model of industrialization has a lot of bad side effects, namely pollution of the water, of the air. And as a result, you know, since the turn of the decade, I would say, I think more and more attention has been given to the environmental consequences of unabated economic growth. So what we have now is an interesting case of China being both, if I can use some metaphors, both being gray and both being green at the same time. And it's a balance that it's trying to strike between, you know, feeding the mouths of a billion over people, but at the same time making sure that there'll be enough resources in the future to feed the next few billions.
Right.
So, you know, while it continues to emphasize economic growth on a yearly basis, it's also investing billions of dollars into the renewable energy industry, for instance. It has made energy efficiency. It realizes that it's, because of its heavy industry, its economy is not particularly energy efficient. And so in the past 5 years, it set out a target to reduce energy consumption per unit of GDP by 20% over the five-year period from 2006 to 2010. And they are going to continue this policy in the next five-year plan. At the same time, they have also announced a target to reduce carbon emissions per unit of GDP. And that would, you know, coupled with also raise sector-specific renewable energy targets in wind, for instance, where they hope to basically grow their installed wind base by 10 times of what they have right now by 2020, and similarly in solar to scale up to 20 gigawatts, which is probably about, I'd say about 10 to 15 times of what they have right now as well. So, you know, I think they see it both as a necessity in terms of the environment, weaning itself off coal, on which they are so reliant on, but also I think they also see the economic strategic value of developing these new technologies and knowing that, you know, these could have a lot of benefits in terms of the exports, because, you know, these they fully understand that clean energy technologies are going to be in huge demand.
You know, at a certain point, you have to recognize the foolishness of backing an old technology that's based on a limited resource that you know one day will be gone, and the progressive smart view, you know, long view of developing alternatives to that very limit, and especially when you know other countries that you'll be competing with economically are still going to be relying on it. So if you've got the U.S. and the European Union relying far too heavily on oil and other fossil fuels and coal and even natural gas to some degree, and you're trying to avoid, sidestep the use of that as much as possible, and at the same time develop technologies where you won't even need it, that when the time comes for everyone else to have run out of those resources, they're going to be coming to you for that technology. And I think it's one of the funny parts about, like, about our culture is that we're supposedly this so commerce-based. We're so, you know, believe in this free market, that innovation comes from the free market, and this is how we live. And yet at the same time, we fight so long and so hard for against the development of this kind of technology as if it's a chore, as if it,
right,
you know, as if it's just an unnecessary thing. It's somebody else's problem down the line. But we're really just leaving ourselves as a country. We will be relying on the countries that develop this technology. Right now, even our wind turbines are being built and designed in China.
That's right. You know, I think, you know, I often get asked the question, you know, what is it of the Chinese government structure, you know, that lends itself to, that gives it an advantage in terms of energy planning? Is it the authoritarian one-party structure, for instance? Does that help, you know, make them, help, you know, allow the government to make quick decisions and implement them quickly? I think, you know, my response to that is actually, it's not so much that because the authoritarian and therefore are not going to face much opposition in whatever decisions they make, but because of the stability of the government, that they are able then to free themselves from all this pervasive short-term election cycle thinking and really think about the long term. So, you know, what China has in terms of energy policies, they're all keyed to like 2020 targets, you know, or, you know, a lot of them are. And so they are able to take a long-term view, a 10-year view. And certainly as the next few years go by, we're going to see 2030 targets and beyond. And I think that really helps, you know, freeing themselves from the short-term thinking and really thinking about the long-term value, long-term sustainability of the economy.
That's true. I also, it's been my experience when traveling in China, too, that as a populace, they are educated in a different way than we are. I find that the fact that a lot of them are taught, you know, Confucius, and they're taught kind of classical thought and classical philosophy at a very young age does factor into their decision making as adults. And we've kind of all but drummed that out of our schools. It is as if all the benefits of Aristotle and Socrates and even Shakespeare have just been kind of left to the fringes of our education system, whereas there it's more of a norm. It really
is.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely true. You know, I think the idea of thinking collectively, you know, it has its pluses and minuses, obviously. You know, the benefit, obviously, of thinking collectively is that you're really putting the interests of society as a whole at heart.
And but I think we're up against a hard break. But I wanted to thank you, Julian, for being with us. Julian Wong, senior policy analyst at AmericanProgress.org. Have a great new year, and we'll talk to you next year.
You too. Thanks for having me. Take
cheers.
Care.
Absolutely. Bye-bye. Bye. I'm Hal Sparks filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show, 1-800-STEP-12. We'll be right back after this.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Good morning to you. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. StephanieMiller.com. I'm Hal Sparks. I am filling in for Stephanie and Chris and Jim while they are on vacation, a much needed, much deserved vacation. And I'm lucky enough this hour to be joined by Igor Volsky, healthcare researcher and blogger for AmericanProgress.org. Igor, you there?
I'm there, Hal. How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm very good, walking on sunshine, as your song put it, after the bill finally passed the Senate.
I know, it's stunning, isn't it? You know, I know there's a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth on the from a lot of progressives, but there's even more so from the right, and I think we should take that as a good sign.
You know, Howard Dean said a couple days ago that if Republicans oppose the bill in such numbers, then there must be something good in it, which I think is a good way of putting it, yeah.
Well, it's because I was speaking a little bit about this in the last hour, but that, you know, they understand the power of incremental change. They understand this chipping away at something over time, that sculptures are not made with dynamite. You know, they're made by slowly but surely chipping away the pieces so that you get exactly what you want.
I think that's right, but I think we also have to be very careful in how we structure this thing and mm-hmm. how much increment we give it, because what we learned on Sunday, you know, basically what we already knew is that the 2010 election, the 2012 election are going to be about health care, that Gingrich admitted what McConnell wouldn't on Meet the Press, and that is that they're going to run on repealing the health care bill. 21 states already have different ways of passing constitutional amendments to mm-hmm. protect their states from health care reform. Now you're going to have it on a national level as well. And if Democrats aren't careful and don't try to front load some of the reforms into the interim years in 2010, 2011, I think a lot of us are going to be in a lot of political hot water when it comes to winning seats or even holding seats.
I totally agree. And I do believe it would be political suicide for them to not move as many of the reforms forward as possible. Obviously, there are elements of bureaucracy that are created when you're moving that many people into the exchange, when you're making it available. There's everything, even just from a practical standpoint on a computer level, the design of that service and opening up. Even if we created Medicare for all, there would still be a delay on how long it would take to implement just because of the nature of making it happen. I get that. But insofar as, you know, bills, you know, a bill that allows for, you know, people not to be dropped if they've got pre-existing conditions, the no lifetime caps, those kind of things, there's no particular reason why that can't be from day one. And Obama has made that case, I know, in private with them, and he's said it a couple of times. He's been pretty close to the chest about a lot of this stuff. And I think that's smart, because, quite frankly, a lot more of it got through because of that.
Part of the fear in moving the regulations up, the pre-existing conditions, the guarantee issue, is that if you start requiring insurers to take everybody and you don't have the individual mandate, and so you only have the sicker people who actually need coverage buying it, you're creating a situation where you're flooding the risk pool with sick people, and that means premiums are going to increase for everybody else.
Right.
So you want to kind of try to balance the regulations with bringing more people in. And again, one of the reasons why the individual mandate is so important is because without having those healthy people in the risk pool, you can't really ask insurers to abide by these new regulations. And if they do, it's certainly going to cost us a whole lot.
That's true. And you also, it's funny that we call everybody healthy people, but a lot of people don't get to, and what we learned from the bankruptcies that occur, a lot of people don't get to pick when they get sick. This seems to be a fallacy that seems to be floated, that we could just kind of count, as the actuarial tables do, on, you know, as you get older, you get sicker. That's pretty much it. And when you're younger, you don't have to worry about it so much. And we have a lot of people in the middle class who've had their entire life savings eaten up by medical bills because of that very thinking. And so the legitimacy of having some, a serious first of all, insurance available to you at an affordable price, and this idea that everybody needs it, because if you do get sick, you don't get to just shelve it off onto emergency rooms and everybody else.
There's a lot said about that healthcare is like car insurance, and of course the Republicans said, well, yes, you're required to buy insurance if you have a car, but you can choose not to have a car, and then you don't have to buy insurance. But of course that doesn't apply to healthcare. We all have bodies. Our bodies will all eventually become sick, and I think there are only two categories. There are the sick people, and then there are the not yet sick people. There's really no such thing as healthy. It's not a constant state of being.
That's a lovely, lovely sentiment. I would say that I would come from the point of view that the body is in a constant state of health, and it gets knocked off of its bean occasionally, and that the health industry should be in the business of pushing us back to our normal stasis of health. Uh-huh. I do think that is true until we get to a point where of reciprocal return, where your body just starts to give out because we're really old. But in that, I think that the one thing we all can agree on is that we are in an international society. When you got things like swine flu and, all kinds of other airborne sicknesses that will over time start gathering, you know, and cause more damage than any terrorism could ever do, You know, I think we have a responsibility to have a situation in place where everybody feels like if they need to go to the emergency room because they feel sick, they should have the ability to go do that as soon as possible, not just for their own benefit, for their own health and their own safety so that they get treatment as soon as possible, but for the rest of us, for everyone else. Because, you know, again, if you let's say you have, you know, a really bad strain of the flu or tuberculosis or something along those lines, you're, if on average, people who have, you know, have no insurance take an they take 3 days before they go to the emergency room, longer than a regular person. And in that 3 days, they come in contact with about 100 people, in that their family comes in contact with them, their family comes in contact with other people. And and that 100 people contacts 1,000 people and 10,000 people, and it just grows and grows and grows. And those 3 days are a long time, according to the CDC. A lot can happen.
Yeah. And yeah. You know, what, one of the benefits we should know if we're talking about the things that happen right away is that prevention services will no longer be attached to cost sharing. So you won't be, you know, going for a physical, you won't have copays to pay. So that
right.
usually created a wall, especially for poorer people, that why am I, you know, I can go to the doctor even if I have insurance, but I sometimes can't afford the copay, so I'll just stay at home and let my chronic condition worsen.
Right.
And of course, we know that most of that spending on healthcare has to do with treating chronic conditions. So if we can prevent them on the front end, we're going to be
right.
spending a lot less money and, of course, keeping people healthier.
Right. And that and again, constantly driving the cost up by waiting until things are worse when they're harder to treat. And this is true for everything from the flu and pneumonia to cancer. And
yeah.
And a lot of, unfortunately, the insurance system has been built up where they have been treating it like car insurance, that where the deductible aspect is more important, not realizing that it actually drives the cost up, that deductible in the beginning, which is usually made specifically to drive people away from going to the doctor unnecessarily. They kind of put that there as a little governor, a financial governor, as it were,
yeah.
so that you're not just going to the doctor every time you have the sniffles for antibiotics that they have to pay for. So they make sure you have your copay or your deductible relatively high to keep you from doing that, which is a shame, because when there's a situation with serious illness and it has kept you from it, the long-term cost of affecting, you know, getting you healthy again is actually way higher than any of that 500, you know, that they got out of you, you know, the first two times you went to the doctor.
Yeah. You know, you make a good point about that we treat, or insurance companies have been treating health insurance like car insurance. There's been, you know, in the last 50 years, I think, a risk shift to individuals and families, and insurers in particular have been really making this push towards consumer-driven medicine,
right.
as Republicans call it, and that's all these high-deductible plans that you can buy that are very expensive, and young people, they're only for young people because
right.
you have such high deductibles. But this general moving away from responsibility in groups or shared responsibility
right.
towards shifting
pools.
All the risk and all the cost to the individual. And that's where insurers are heading. That's what they ultimately want, to move everybody into this consumer-driven structure where you only really have insurance for really healthy people, and you let the government and Medicaid and Medicare take the sicker individuals.
Right.
That's the business model.
Yeah. Well, and I think a functional one for them to a limited
that's
extent
right.
until everybody gets tired of it and we just eventually move to single-payer, because it's clear that other countries that have it actually offer better health care long term than their life expectancy and their happiness index and their general health are way higher. And
I'm very hesitant, though, of the argument that if we let things become even worse, then all of a sudden people will
right.
realize how broken the system is and they'll move to single payer. I mean, you know, things were a lot better 50 years ago or 60 years ago when Truman first introduced health care reform, a single payer system. Now we're have a lot more uninsured, the costs are a lot higher, and we're not even considering single payer. You know, if you look at the history and the trajectory of reform over time, it's really gotten worse.
I agree.
You know, cycle after cycle after cycle. And so to my friends on the left who say, let's not take this deal, or let's not use all of our momentum chips on this imperfect bill, let's wait till we have a bigger crisis when it demands
right.
single payer, I mean, I just don't think that's the way the politics works at all.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that it speaks to a level of naivete that has left us in the lurch for quite some time, that a lot of progressive politics have stalled where I actually think the general populace actually likes them. One of the reasons why I think people think, the government is broken or democracy is broken a lot of times is because the things that they want actually don't make it through. And the reason is because I think we on the left actually do have more of a connection with what actually helps people in their day-to-day lives, that addresses the genuine lives of other people. I don't think most of us run into the death tax every day and have to deal with it, nor are we scared to death of gay marriage. These are the issues that seem to get a lot of service on the right, but the progressive agendas don't necessarily get through because we've had this all or nothing kind of fight to us. We haven't dealt with the politics as they are. We've dealt with the politics as we would like them to be and have never actually made the progress that we want. So as progressives, we kind of need to make some actual progress to keep the name.
That's a good point, and just to remember that every single large piece of social legislation, things that Democrats are so proud of, from Medicare to Social Security to the Clean Air Act, that all of those things were built upon in the years to come, that
right.
This wasn't a perfect piece of legislation that somehow passed and then they were done with it, that this work is far from over. Yes, we passed reform last week or earlier this week. But now it's time to A, implement it, B, make sure that people are seeing benefits right away as soon as possible,
right.
And plugging any holes that are in this bill, and I'm afraid there are going to be many.
Well, of course, there are going to be ones that we're aware of, and there's going to be ones that we find out later that actually don't work, and I think that's been true of the highway system. That's been true of the Defense Department. I mean, if you look at it's interesting that they'll scream about the bureaucracy of how can you let the government run healthcare? Well, we let the government fight our wars for us. I mean, in a lot of ways, the Blackwater edition they've been big fans of or whatever. But the truth is, they'll never just kind of freak out about I blame the soldiers because they're government employees and you can't trust a government employee. It's a little silly. They pick and choose that argument, and I think in healthcare, I've always associated it more. They hate the general welfare kind of clause and the idea, but I actually look at it as common defense because if my life is in danger from a germ or a cancer cell, it's just as in danger as someone was pointing a gun at me. And if you can stand between me and it as a governmental entity, in the same way that a fire department stands between me and me getting caught on fire and the police are there to protect me from being killed, technically speaking, It fits in that same general zone. And I think if we started addressing it as such, we'd go, well, yeah, the government does have a vested interest in protecting you from contagious disease. That's why we have the CDC. That's why we have the National Institute for Health. That's why the National Institute for Health actually supports and funds a lot of the development that we have in the medical establishment in this country. That we talk about how, government should have no play in it. And then they've had nothing but play in it for the last few decades. A lot of it, from the Genome Project to a lot of the advances in medicine, a lot of them have been done by government funds, government-funded studies, government-funded laboratories at some of the major universities, the like. So I think we ought to take a break. I want to thank you for being on with me, Igor Volsky. People need to check out your writing at AmericanProgress.org. Your most recent one was about Catholic hospitals endorsing the Senate abortion compromise. Fascinating article, because the bishops at the same time came out against it almost exactly the same time. So I really recommend that people read your article about it. So, and thanks for being on with me.
Thank you, Al.
And Happy New Year.
Oh, you too.
Absolutely. Talk to you again. Bye. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller. I'll be back with your calls right after this. 1-800-STEPH-12, stephaniemiller.com.
It's full of witches and strange creatures of the night.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
You can't even tell that that's the cult until that part comes in. And as soon as that part comes in, oh, that's the cult. I recognize that as being the cult. But the first one, it's, good old Ian. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. Chris and Jim are hopefully enjoying their time off, getting some sleep. And I know Chris is doing some traveling. I know, and I think for the most part, Steph is trying to settle into her apartment in New York. I want to get to some calls because you guys have been holding on. You've been fantastic. And we got 2 minutes in this break. I just want to get to Michael before because he's been holding the longest. Michael, are you there?
Hey, Hal.
Hiya.
Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
You know, with the terrorist situation with that Delta airline, that is something that was caused by the Bush administration. And let me explain why.
Okay.
Because the thing is that, if you remember, that they were the ones that set the security standards. They said you can bring box cutters, knives, even maybe some explosives on, you know, those little firecrackers crap and all that stuff. But yet they wanted to harass people like this new mother that have bottles of her own breast milk to
right.
feed to her baby
well,
while flying.
Yeah.
They wouldn't allow her on. And then, you know, these Republicans like that Peter King, who I like to play doctor and prescribe to him, saying, take two STFUs and don't call me in the morning. It's people like him that supported the Bush administration stands to begin with. So the Republicans that keep saying that, oh, yeah, Bush kept us safe for 8 years, understand this.
Well done.
You're wrong.
Well done. I appreciate the call. I think you make a good point in that they allowed the cigarette lobby to allow you to keep lighters. There was this big fight afterwards that you should be able to bring a lighter on a plane, and they've still left that in place. You could still do that now. You couldn't for a while, but then they turned it back on instantly. Kind of silly, but breast milk we have to test, and we have to make a woman drink her own breast milk. But you could bring on a lighter. Up to three. I'm Hal Sparks filling in for Steph. We'll be back right after this, taking your calls. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. Live streaming at halsparks.com on the Hot and Sexy Cam Show. And, of course, follow me on Twitter at Hal Sparks. We'll be back right after this. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, and that's the Reverend Heartbeat. Tony, I love your choices. He and I have very different musical styles, but we have a tremendous amount of respect for each other. I mean, obviously we're both metalheads on some of it, but I definitely come from the shred background, and you come from more the punk background. And somehow we managed to meet in the middle and find different styles that we both like, so that when he plays something, it's a nice surprise for me and vice versa, and that's a really cool thing. And I think that is how the political process should actually go. Do you like that? Do you like how I was able to just segue right into that? Let's see. Here we go. I want to get to, let's get to Mike in Chicago, because I always give preferential treatment to everybody in Chicago. How are you?
Hey, what's going on, Hal?
I'm great.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. You too.
All the wonderful weather back home here.
I know. I'm very I'm one of those people. I don't fear the snow, and I love it, you know, and if I could have the same kind of industry reach that I have when I'm here in town, I would live in Chicago and do it, no question.
Well, excellent. Well, the reason I wanted to call was 2 points. The first thing is, where's the right wing now complaining that this guy in the airplane, he's being detained in Detroit? I thought we can't let terrorists, you know, be detained in America. I thought that was a bad thing.
Oh, absolutely. He should be immediately shipped to Gitmo. And then
rendition from there.
Yeah, and to put into another country because nobody here can handle it. Our law enforcement is not strong enough to be able to deal with it.
Right, and I got another question. Maybe you know the answer to. I've written to Jonathan Turley. I've asked Tom Hartman this question. Maybe you know.
Mm-hmm.
If we decided to take the military tribunal route of justice for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, wouldn't he then be considered a prisoner of war? Thus, he would be protected under the Geneva Convention, and we finally could prosecute Bush and Cheney for war crimes, for torture.
Not technically. He would not qualify as a prisoner of war because he wasn't specifically a member of a country we were at war with specifically. That's been the problem with both Iraq and Afghanistan, is that we weren't technically at war with the governments of these countries. So and they weren't specifically aligned with the governments of those countries. So they're not technically so that's really that really is the issue more than anything.
Oh. I wasn't sure if it was because he didn't sign a declaration of war or if it was because they kept using the euphemisms, you know, enhanced interrogation.
Right. That's a totally different zone. There's still an element of where they're able to do, you know, you can still try them for breaking our laws. That shouldn't be, you don't even have to try them under the Geneva Convention. We have laws against torture in this country. And if the evidence is there, when I think it is there, I think it will just show up years later, kind of like the info on the Kennedy assassination and other stuff that just keeps pouring out decades later, because our government, all three branches, do a lot to protect their own, as it were. I think eventually we're going to see, you know, this information, that it led all the way to them. If that were the case, and if it did come out sooner.
And, well, hopefully it happens before the election, because I brought up this point also. The three biggest supporters of Obama, other than the unions, were the anti-war activists, the gay and lesbian community, and the people who want to see the Bush administration in The Hague.
Sure.
And they have not done anything to appease these groups, and I think it could really
I do disagree on one, especially on, and we've been dealing with this Don't Ask, Don't Tell and DOMA as well, is that, if he fixed it with a signing statement, the next president could also fix it with a signing statement. If you dismantle it as a law, it takes a long time, and you have to develop consensus, as we've seen in the healthcare debate, how much work that actually takes. But if you're capable of doing it, which he's asked for the biggest review of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the military's history, and there's only one hardliner in there that's really holding out, that's slowing up the process so that they can't get it through. And insofar as DOMA, progressive Democratic representative has already put forward a bill to reverse it. And if it has to just make its way through the House and Senate, but he's already said he will sign it. Unequivocally, he will sign the bill if it gets through. DOMA's law, so he can't just overturn that anyways.
But Don't Ask, Don't Tell, he does have the authorization to at least stop the enforcement of it until Senate can overturn it, and he hasn't done that.
Well, that's true, but I think he's trying to allow the military, to basically save face in the process so that it can actually get done and that they won't balk and turn it back on the minute he leaves. That's really the issue, is that how do you make permanent change? And permanent change tends to be a lot less sexy. That's the issue. And that's what he's up against. And I think, you know, the change we can believe in idea is a change that actually shifts the country. It isn't this Bush signing statement mentality. You know what I mean? I think we got intoxicated with how much power it seemed that Bush had during these years. And we allowed them to have because of, you know, our 9/12 mentality, which Glenn Beck will say was our kumbaya moment. I would say it was our fearful xenophobic moment that allowed things like the Patriot Act to go through. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially with FISA and everything. And then because this president isn't grabbing the power by the reins, we're surprised.
Right, exactly. But you have to recognize that as soon as Bush left office and Obama came in, his first 3 days in office, he was overturning. Remember all the signing statements of Bush's that he was just checking off?
Right.
One piece of paper right after the other. And that was because Bush used that methodology. It's because a lot of the stuff, he thought he was going to have massive control. He thought he was going to have the Senate and the Congress through his whole reign, as it were. And then they would just pass it off because they have this, they get intoxicated by power. And then when they lost, when the Democrats actually came into power, he couldn't do that anymore. So the signing statements actually gained more speed. They actually started doing more of them. And so basically what Obama came in and did was, let's just turn them right back over. Okay, that's done. That only works under his administration. That's the end of it. We want lasting change. We want a pivotal shift that is long term. None of us would have signed up for a signing statement that allowed people of color to marry whites and vice versa. None of us would have said that was enough. Correct?
Right.
But
that process
took almost 20 years. And if you look at the civil rights movement as it started, as my dear friend David Bender would say, it started in 1893. The civil rights movement, in the 50s and 60s, which arguably is still going on today, we're still dealing with getting equal rights for minorities in this country in a massive scale. Not even just minor elements. We're still dealing with that now. But the big shifts came and they looked ugly. They took a lot of them 6 years to get the legislation through. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and like you said, even though the minorities, they're not per se persecuted like they were in the 50s, they still have the profiling to deal with.
Exactly.
And
I think if you look at healthcare and you look at Don't Ask, Don't Tell and DOMA and the issues that we're talking about, where people are going, I feel so betrayed by Obama. Well, the reason they feel betrayed by Obama is not because of something he said and isn't doing long term, because the incremental change is there. If you look at his actual efforts, his actual bills, the things that they put forward, even like just recently, he did this transparency in government executive order, which caused a 3-month review of how to make the government as transparent as it's ever been in our history. Which went by under the radar. They released this statement on the White House website and did not hit the mainstream news at all. The Republicans freaked out about it a little bit, but they didn't want to draw too much attention to it because they know the American people like it and they can't argue against it. So they just let it sit.
And, right, exactly. It's like the PMRC's ranting and raving about Judas Priest. That just sells more albums.
Exactly. And there's two sides to that. On the one side, they know that they don't want to help us in that regard. They don't want to help us sell more records, as it were. And on our side, we don't want to give away our cards too much. And I think that's what, the process that Obama has been doing, and not being like, I'm for a single payer, I'm hanging my hat on single payer, or I'm hanging my hat on a public option as it stands in the House bill. Then it was very easy. Then all they needed to do was put the right pressure on the right couple of guys, kills it, and then he's considered a lame duck, and they have this massive win. But if he says the goal is more important, the ends is more important than the means in this case, as long as we get this group of people insured, as long as we keep people from being kicked off if they have pre-existing conditions, as long as we solve these kind of things, what it looks like in the mechanics, I could care less about. I personally think the public option is the way to go. That's what he said. But he was open to other alternative ideas that solve the problem. And that's what we really have to recognize. It's not that he said one thing as done another. He said, I think this is the best way to do it. I'm willing to be proven wrong if you have a better alternative. And in many cases, if you look at In the element of the exchange where they allow for nonprofits to be created that are actually run by government oversight, which is effectively a have your cake and stuff it into the mouths of the conservatives too kind of moment, where we have a public situation where the government can't oversee this, can have a nonprofit much like Medicare where 3% is towards overhead, we can set limits on how much the cost is. We have that as a possibility, and that can grow into a public option later, but we don't have the bureaucracy of the government having to create all new paperwork and all new system so that the right can't complain about it. They can't come out and say, this is government bureaucracy, because it's technically not. It's a nonprofit overseen by the government. So it deflates their argument, and then later on, if the people go, you know what? What we really want is a bureaucracy, a new bureaucratic entity run by the government, because that would be a better way to do it. Then we have called for that, and the structure is already there for it to exist. Right now, if we blow this up, we go right back to zero. Then the public option is gone.
Okay, I was going to say, but also time isn't on our side because it's inevitable the Democrats will lose seats in 2010. And now when we've got
I do not think I agree that is something they should be concerned about. And I think they should also be focused on. I do not think it's a fait accompli. And I think it's been very overplayed that the Republicans are going to automatically pick up seat because people are not happy with the Dems. Because if the Dems have a 40% approval rating, the Republicans have a 12% approval rating, and they're also dissipated by the fact that they have basically separated into a second, a two-party system of their own inside it, which is the teabaggers on one side, which is sort of this racist enclave of what people consider themselves to be, foundationalists. They believe in the founding fathers, they don't believe in the separation of church and state part, but they're big on the black people are three-fifths of a person part. They pick and choose teabagger side. And then the absolute corporatists, of which, unfortunately, the Democrats that we have to deal with the most, the Ben Nelsons, the Mary Landrews, and the former Democrat Joe Lieberman, are the corporatists. We have to deal with those guys. Those are the work. Those are the guys we have to push out, because I really don't think they care about the ramifications of anything that they sign. It's really about their secondary payday. Either getting reelected and getting money from these people for their reelection or getting paid after they leave office. I think Lieberman, to some degree, has reached a point where he is no longer interested in winning next time. He just knows he's got a job waiting for him in the health industry as a consultant or getting fees from these companies as a lobbyist, essentially, once he leaves office. And I think once that's what happens when you pull the trigger on him big. That's why I think they were hesitant to remove his chairmanship, you know, or his committee chairs.
Yeah, because they wanted the votes to go through first before they pull the blanket out on.
But they also know that if he thinks he's going to lose all power, he's just going to ditch entirely, and then we can't count on him for anything. He's just going to basically, you know, he might announce that he won't run again, that kind of thing. And so it's a really delicate balance. So we would not be complaining about the Democrats at all. We would not even be complaining about Obama at all if we had a solid progressive majority in the Senate. We do not. We have 60 votes by a hair's breadth. We have two independents, Bernie Sanders, whom we can always count on, and Joe Lieberman, who we can almost never count on, who essentially caucuses with the Dems just so he can tell the Republicans what's going on. And then you've got eight, you know, of these hardcore conservative Dems from small red states with entire populations smaller than one-tenth of a major city. That's nuts. And so to claim that somehow we have a mandate, we also have a majority, and we should be able to shove through whatever we want is foolish. And it creates this environment where we're going to shoot the hostage. And I'm not willing to do that. I think that's silly. And I think, if anything, what we should be getting mad about is not where Obama has had to make compromises, nor how Harry Reid managed to squeeze some votes out, but how we get the people he had to compromise with out.
Because the faux progressives.
Exactly. Because I think we're getting so caught up in how awful Ben Nelson is and how ridiculous Joe Lieberman acts, and we're forgetting how amazing Al Franken is and how this new wave of progressive Dems are out there. They are there, and they really do care about the direction of the country. They do really care about how their bills that they write affect human beings. And I think we lose sight of that when we get pissed because it's been 11 months and we haven't gotten everything we wanted. I think it's silly. And I really, like, I can't tell you how important it is that we not pull out at this point. And because they're counting on it. They are counting on us doing this.
Yeah, and then have to listen to Fox for the next year, rub it in everyone's face. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, Hal, thanks very much. I don't want to tell you.
No worries. Things. Thank you. I got a bunch of other calls, and I want to get to them, and I thank you for the call. How much time we got, Tony? We got a couple minutes. We should take a break. We're going to take a break, and I'm going to get to the calls at the bottom of the hour. And then we're getting towards the end of the show today. It's crazy. It's been a great conversation. You guys are awesome. I'll be back right after this. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I'm going to get to Julie and Tim and Ben when I get back right after this. StephanieMiller.com, and of course you can watch us streaming live on HalSparks.com or follow me on Twitter at HalSparks. We'll be right back.
And we'll be right back.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph while she's away on vacation. Little Wasp singing I Don't Need No Doctor. I think that's good for the healthcare debate, you know. That's actually, truth be told, that's how I live. I don't recommend it for everybody, but I actually don't have a regular physician. I have an acupuncturist and an herbalist that I go to. I use Western doctors for surgery. That's it. That's my system or whatever. My health insurance, I have it through my union, through the Screen Actors Guild and through AFTRA, and they do not cover my alternate care, so it comes out of pocket for the most part. So most of my health care is paid just kind of cash on the barrel head as far as it's as I'm concerned. My doctor's Doctor Who says Vampy Vet in our chat room on Ustream. You could do worse, I suppose. So I want to get to some of our callers that have been hanging on for quite some time. Tim in Minneapolis, thank you for hanging on as long as you have. Tim, you there?
Oh, no problem. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. You know, we have the most incredible opportunity to change anything we want in our government, and we don't use it. And as far as the internet goes, we literally could set up our own bills, our own laws, and everybody can vote on it. You put your name down. You have to have some kind of form of ID. And for take for the health care, for example, we could actually write our own bill and submit it. And literally the people could check off what they wanted on it and what they didn't want and go by the percentages and submit that to those.
I'm for it. I'm for it. Absolutely. I think if you know, again, it will motivate who it will motivate, and other people will just poo-poo it. And I think that's what you'd be almost
exactly.
You'd be almost in the same situation that we're in right now, actually. But I agree with what you're saying. And I also think that doesn't necessarily just have to apply to healthcare. I mean, that can be true on
anything.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, personally, I mean, these guys, personally, I think we should have a bill out there that basically says any congressman, any senator, any member of government in higher government, basically, who actually accepts a job after they vote on a bill for, let's say that these guys are voting for the healthcare bill and they accept a job or a member of their family or friends or whatever it is, that work for these people, go to jail. I don't think they should be getting perks. I don't think they should be getting any benefits whatsoever.
Right.
And any money that they get that's donated goes to the general government fund, and the government.
I think that's an interesting. Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. Obviously, campaign finance reform is so incredibly important in this process as well. But you might have hit on something interesting, and I appreciate the call. You might have hit on something interesting in that maybe it goes to a pooled situation that if you do want to donate out of your own funds, you go, okay, I'm donating to the Dems or I'm donating to this as a party in general. But that's it. Like it become and it's a heavy oversight. This idea though that corporations could somehow. By the way, Keith from Milwaukee wanted to talk about campaign finance reform, so it's kind of perfect.
Yeah, and I think you might have taken a smidgen of my thunder here, but boy, I tell you, Hal, this whole thing about these small purple states, blue dog states, dominating the discussion. I mean, let's face it: when you talk about Max Baucus and Blanche Lincoln and the others, you know, they're not raising the money from their own people within the states.
Nope.
I mean, they're getting money shoved into their pockets by
because
by
they
the
have
private.
To because they don't have enough people actually to get the kind of money that it costs to run a senatorial campaign.
Right, and the thing, you know, I think the thing we need to point out here is that, you know, and you've done a great job of pointing out the limitations of what President and Harry Reid can do. But the thing we got to realize is we're not going to get reform here or anywhere unless we reform campaign finance first.
Right. That's true. I totally agree. Thanks for the call. And then I want to get to Julie real quick. Oh, we got 30 seconds. I got to go. I'm sorry I didn't get to everybody. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks for joining us in the chat on Ustream. Of course, we'll be here tomorrow at Hal Sparks on Twitter, halsparks.com. You can watch, join in the chat in the chat room. You can also call us at 1-800-STEP-12 and enter that in your phone, stephaniemiller.com. I'm Hal Sparks. Have a wonderful day and Happy New Year.